This is the last whole lesson that we're going to spend looking at it. So let's get right into the introduction here. We've got a lot of ground to cover today, as always. So introduction. Today will be our ninth and final lesson on the 1560 Geneva Bible. Over the preceding eight lessons, we have considered the following aspects of this important Bible. So in lesson 128, we looked first at its production and its influence. All right, the impact of the Geneva Bible on both English Christians and the English language cannot be overstated. Once it appeared in 1560, the Geneva Bible became the Bible of the common Englishman for the next century. So we looked at a lot of points about that in lesson 128. That was the first lesson that I gave on the Geneva Bible. Then we spent three lessons, lesson 129, 130, and 131, talking about the Geneva Bible, the Old Testament. Now, let me read the statement there in the notes. So much time was spent on the Old Testament because the Geneva Bible marks the first time that the entire Old Testament had been translated out of Hebrew into English. Recall that William Tyndale had translated portions of the preserved Hebrew text into English before his martyrdom, but was unable to complete the entire translation. Later translators, such as Coverdale, were not proficient in Hebrew and therefore relied on translations into other languages such as Latin and German. So I spent three lessons talking about the Old Testament because the Geneva Bible is groundbreaking in its Old Testament because it's the first time the entire Bible is translated into English out of Hebrew as far as the Old Testament is concerned. We went into a lot of detail already a couple different times looking at the different portions that Tyndale did before he was martyred, but the Geneva Bible is significant in its Old Testament for those reasons. Remember, Coverdale was not proficient in Hebrew, and so he is largely translating from Latin, German, and other sources into English. When he does his Bible in 1533, he is not translating Hebrew, okay? So then in lesson 132, we looked at the New Testament. And just brief statement there, the New Testament text of the 1560 Geneva Bible was a slightly revised presentation of the text found in the 1557 New Testament. So we previously discussed that. And then in lessons 133 and 134, we looked at the contents and features of the Geneva Bible. And we looked at all the items that are listed there, the title page, the table of contents, the epistle dedicatory to Queen Elizabeth. We looked at the address to the reader, the arguments and chapter summaries, the illustrations and maps, the tables and concordances. And then if you go to page 2, last Sunday we spent a whole lesson talking about the marginal notes in lesson 135. And here we looked at three categories of marginal notes. Specifically, we looked at number 1, anti-papal notes. Second, we looked at Calvinistic notes. Third, anti-monarchical notes. And we further noted that it was this third category of notes that was the particular that should say ire, like he didn't like them, the particular ire of King James and motivated him to authorize a new translation in 1604. So we looked at those three categories of notes. Before that, we had looked at general things about what they were trying to accomplish with the marginal notes. But we spent a lot of time, eight lessons, more than 8 hours of study on the Geneva Bible so far, all right? So today what we want to do is conclude our study of the Geneva Bible by considering the later details of its history. And that's essentially the main point that we're going to be looking at here today. And then we'll stop periodically for any questions or comments. So page 2, the later history of the Geneva Bible. In lesson 128, we presented a mountain of statistical data in terms of editions and printings bearing witness to the immense popularity of the Geneva Bible. Blackford Condit summarizes the popularity of the Geneva Bible in his 1882 publication, The History of the English Bible. He says, quote, "The Geneva Bible was a decided advance upon all former translations. The accuracy of its scholarship and the plainness of Saxon English commended it both to the learned and unlearned. It became more popular than any previous version. Though not printed in England for several years after it was first issued, yet it very soon became the Bible of the household, and for more than a century and a half maintained its place as the Bible of the people. Born of persecution and in exile, it was regarded as the peculiar child of Protestantism. A lively bond of sympathy existed between the brethren at home and those at Geneva during the Marian persecution, so that whether at home or abroad, they all suffered in a common cause. The fruit thereof of the labors of the brethren abroad was the more highly prized. So, remember that this Bible is coming from these exiles in Geneva who fled to get away from the reign of Mary I or Bloody Mary, who tried to move England back to Catholicism and was persecuting Protestants, right? So because of the specific history of this and the identification that people had with each other in this persecution, and the fact that it was done in Geneva and it was viewed as a distinctly Protestant Bible, it definitely had a higher degree of acceptance amongst the people of England at that time. So Condent suggests that Queen Elizabeth's policies regarding public preaching served to reinforce the popularity of the Geneva Bible on account of its extensive marginal notes and study help. So let's look at that quote. Now this is going to bring up an interesting thing that we need to note. And we'll probably end up talking about it again next week a little bit. Says, quote, and as Queen Elizabeth's policy developed, she became more and more opposed to the preaching of the gospel. Now, Elizabeth did not like public preaching. Okay? Elizabeth never moved to suppress the printed Bible. She did not like, though, public preaching. So Elizabeth is never going to ban the Bible. Elizabeth is never going to restrict the printing of the Bible. Elizabeth is never going to restrict the access of Englishmen to the Bible. She's never going to do that. But she doesn't particularly like preaching. Consequently, the people were dependent for instruction upon the annotations of the Holy Scriptures. Upon the ascension of Queen Elizabeth, high expectations were entered by Protestants of royal favor, and on this account, undue license was taken by them. Hey, guys. We're going through those notes right there on the back. Where am I at? Upon ascension of Queen Elizabeth, high expectations were entered by Protestants of royal favor, and on account undue license was taken by them, so that partly on this account and partly on the account of her aversion to the plain gospel, she required Archbishop Grindal to abridge the number of preachers and to put down the religious exercise of prophesying, quote, urging that it was good for the church to have few preachers, that three or four might suffice for a country, and that the reading of homilies to the people was sufficient. So there's a lot to unpack in that statement. Okay, so let's break it down. First of all, this statement, upon the ascension of Queen Elizabeth, this statement right here, upon the ascension of Queen Elizabeth, high expectations were entered by the Protestants. Remember when we studied the Epistle Dedicatory to the Geneva Bible a few weeks ago, and they are very forward in their language, almost telling the Queen what she should do. Remember when we observed that type of language in there? These guys think that because Elizabeth is going to be favorable to Protestantism, that automatically means that things are going to be great, and she's just going to let them do whatever they want. The reality is that Elizabeth is still a monarch and had her own thoughts about what should be done. So what she thought should happen is that there should be a handful of preachers that would preach, and then what they preach in their homilies would then be written down and then read out loud to other people at other churches. She did not want there to be an abundance of preachers. So, I mean, you think about just the city of Grand Rapids this morning and how many different preachers are there right now that are preaching who knows what. Okay? From her point of view, as a monarch, that was bad. She didn't want that. She wanted to limit the number of people that were preaching. So, obviously, that's not necessarily going to be a thing that the Protestants love. And so the reason I'm bringing that up is for the following reason. Therefore, the Geneva Bible endeared itself more to the people because did they have all of these notes and all these references and all this material that was in it? Okay, so that's another reason why it was so popular. So anybody got any questions about that? So bottom of page 2, while Elizabeth may have been adverse to public preaching, she did not move to officially suppress the English scriptures. That said, it would be 15 years before the popular Geneva Bible would be published on English shores. Conant suggests that this points toward the fact that some within the Anglican Church did not relish the popularity of the Geneva Bible. Listen, here's one thing that you got to get. The English Bible for the first 250 to 300 years of its existence, was it a political book? Did King Henry VIII burn William Tyndale for political reasons? Yeah. And it remained a political book well into the 1600s, if not into the 1700s, okay? So the fortunes of the Bible, the English Bible, for English-speaking people, is going to be largely dependent on the monarch, the ruling class, and what that ruling class's policy is going to be toward the Bible. So Elizabeth is negative towards preaching, but is never negative towards people having what? The Bible for themselves. All right? So that in and of itself would be a step forward from what had existed before, right? Where Englishmen are being rounded up and burnt, and piles of Bibles are being burnt, and all this stuff's going on to suppress the Bible in English. Elizabeth never did that. So, let's look at the next quote on page 3. The many excellencies of the Geneva Bible gave it a wide circulation, though not printed in England until 1575. Yet, like the New Testament of Tyndale, it was printed abroad and scattered broadcast throughout England and Scotland. So universal was this Bible accepted that it was read from the pulpit, quoted in sermons, cited by authors, and adopted in the family. The bishops and those who stood at the head of the university gave their preference to this version, though many of them, from their ecclesiastical connections, might justly be supposed to have been prejudiced against it. This marked superiority of the Genevan to the bishops, as well as to the Great Bible, gave it a place independent of its free church origin. But while it enjoyed this preeminence, the fact that it was not printed in England until 15 years after its publication at Geneva argues that it could not have been altogether acceptable to those in high places. So I'm going to stop there and make a comment. So we know that's going to be true because the next Bible that's going to come into existence is going to be the Bishop's Bible. Now, why do you think it's called the Bishop's Bible? Any guesses or surmisings about why they'd call it the Bishop's Bible?
Because maybe pastors were more allowed to preach at that time?
Because it was translated by Anglican bishops who didn't like what? The Geneva Bible. So it's still a political hot potato. While the Bible is no longer being suppressed, there's still dispute in the English church at the time over this issue. So the high Anglican churchmen don't like the Geneva Bible because it has in it all this marginal notes and all this stuff, and they think it's too Protestant and too Calvinistic and too whatever, and so they don't like it. Okay, so even though the people, the common man, the everyday Englishman, is reading the Geneva Bible and loving their Geneva Bible, etc., the highbrow churchmen of the Anglican Church in the ecclesiastical seats of power, they don't necessarily love it, and so as a result, they're going to assemble, and in 1568, they're going to produce the Bishop's Bible as a competitor to what?
To the Geneva Bible.
Okay, but we'll get into all that next time. It's true that Queen Elizabeth issued a patent to John Bodley for the term of 7 years to imprint the English Bible, finished in the present year of our Lord, 1503 score. So that's a 7-year printing patent on the 1560 Geneva Bible that Elizabeth is issuing to the Queen's printer. Okay? Now, let me say just something about that. So, could Joe Schmo print the English Bible under Elizabeth's jurisdiction?
No.
No. You had to, so only a crown issued patent would give you the right to print even the Geneva Bible. So let's say Ernie wants to open up a print shop and print Geneva Bibles. Can he do that legally in England under the reign of Elizabeth without a crown patent to do so? He cannot. Now, understand, that is not the same thing as a modern copyright, but it is a limitation on who is able to print the text. Okay? So only this guy, John Bodley, has the authority from the Queen to print the 1560 Geneva Bible at that time for 7 years. So nobody else can do that legally within Britain or within England at that time. The same thing is going to exist for the King James. When the King James comes out in 1611, it is pursuant to a patent to the King's printer. So Joe Schmo cannot just start printing the King James Bible. And in fact, if you look at, let me just show you this. I wasn't intending to do this, but we'll call this up because I want folks to see what I'm talking about. So I'm going to be preaching later this morning on Colossians chapter 2, but we'll just load up Colossians chapter 1. So this is Blue Letter Bible. This is a popular search engine, etc., that's free on the internet for people. But notice what it says down here under the King James text. It says, the authorized version, or King James version, 1611-1769, outside of the United Kingdom, the King James version is in the public domain. What does that mean? What does that mean in the United States?
Anybody
can print it, right? But notice, what, within the United Kingdom, the rights to the King James are vested in the crown. That is still true today. That in any jurisdiction under the Crown's authority in the United Kingdom, still they have to have a patent print right to print the text.
I thought it was for 7 years.
That was back here. They keep reissuing patents. When a patent expires, you just reissue a new one. Or somebody applies for one and then they issue them to whoever they want to issue them to.
One other question. When was printing actually prevalent? Because when did the printing press start? I thought a lot of it was all handwritten by scribes.
So there's two whole lessons, previous lessons about the printing press. The printing press is like 1458.
Oh, that's early.
When Gutenberg invents the printing press. And then that moves things out of the what we would call the manuscript period. In the manuscript period, everything is a result of hand what? Hand copies, right? And then with the printing press, we come into the period of what we might say is the printed codex or the printed book. So that's going to change a lot of things, right? So John Wycliffe's Bible from the 1380s are handwritten copies. William Tyndale's Bible, New Testament from 1526, is the first printed English Bible. Okay?
Now, did people have those or just the churches?
Which ones? The Tyndale Bibles or the Lollard or the Wycliffe Bibles?
Well, I'm just wondering when they became more prevalent outside the church itself.
It was, so there was with Wycliffe, there's a group of people known as the Lollards who possessed copies and they were constantly making more copies and those would be handwritten. With Tyndale's Bible, it's the first time, you might argue it's the first time that a ton of people have access to the Bible because of the printing press and the fact that they were relatively cheap.
Yeah.
Handwritten codices are always more expensive than printed texts because of the time and effort that goes into actually making the handwritten copy. So there's a democratization, if you will, of the Bible once the printing press comes in. And this happens all through Europe. It happens in Germany with Luther's Bible. It happens in England. It happens all over the place. But this patent, how we got on this was this statement in this quote about this right, this 7-year patent to print the text. That would apply even with the Geneva Bible, that you could not just willy-nilly print the text. And my point in showing you that quote from there from the Blue Letter Bible is to show you that it's still that way today in areas under the Crown's authority. So we're halfway through page 3. Notwithstanding this, the Geneva Bible was not printed in England previous to the death of Archbishop Parker. So what does that tell you? Did Archbishop Parker like the Geneva Bible? He did not. And would he exercise his authority to try to at least make it so they couldn't be printed in England? To this fact joins another quite as significant, which is that it was often printed after his death, and there seems abundant ground for the supposition that the Archbishop used his influence against it. Henceforth, however, the Geneva Bible was more frequently printed than any other version. It became popular, particularly in Scotland. It was first printed in Scotland, which was in 1576 to 1579. People differ about when that happens. I'll say more about that later. After the issuance of the Bishop's Bible in 1568, a version intended by the Episcopal authorities to supersede the Geneva Bible, the latter was by no means set aside. An estimate made by Mr. Andrews shows that of the 130 editions of the Bible and Testaments published between 1560 and 1603, 90 were of the Geneva version. And if the comparison be limited to Bibles alone, then of the 85 editions issued, 60 were of the Geneva. These facts show that there was freedom in the reign of Elizabeth for printing and circulating the scriptures, and especially that the people were partial to the Genevan version. Anybody got any questions or comments? So, was Elizabeth suppressing the Bible?
No.
Were people, and in that climate, in that religious and economic climate, which Bible were people buying the most often? It was the Geneva. It was far exceeding the Bishop's Bible after the Bishop's Bible came out. So the influence of the Geneva Bible upon English culture cannot be overstated. Quote, "The Geneva Bible was the book of the household when men such as Bacon," that would be Francis Bacon, father of modern scientific method, okay, pretty important guy in Western civilization, Raleigh, that would be Sir Walter Raleigh, who founded the colony at Roanoke Island, Herbert, Hooker, Spencer, Sidney, and Shakespeare were all growing into manhood. So all of these great men of English civilization, what Bible did they grow up reading and hearing read? The Geneva Bible, okay? Through its general use, this Bible became not only the standard of the language, but a powerful influence in withstanding the public taste, furnishing, as it did, a noble example in word and phrase of pure English. So when Shakespeare writes his plays and he makes biblical allusions, he's always using what Bible? The Geneva Bible. Okay? So after its publication in 1560, the Geneva Bible went through at least two revisions, in 1576 and again in 1599. The 1576 revision was undertaken by Loris Thompson, Conant states the following regarding Thompson's work. Was a P silent and non-existent on that one? Okay. Quote, "On account of the high esteem in which this translation was held, it was often substituted in the Geneva Bible for the New Testament version of 1560. Thompson was a noted linguist, commanding as he did a knowledge of 12 languages. So let me kind of try to tell you what goes on here, okay? So we know that in 1557 there's the Geneva New Testament. We know that 3 years later in 1560 you've got the complete Geneva Bible. Then we have this edition that we're talking about here from 1576, and that marker's not cooperating, which is the Thompson edition, or we'll just say the Thompson Geneva Bible. So what he does is he rewrites a bunch of the marginal notes and makes some minor revisions to the actual translation or to the actual text. Okay? So let me just explain something to you about this. When I was studying and researching about the Geneva Bible, I would read these statements that were contradictory to each other. For example, I was reading some things about the book of Romans and how the marginal notes in Romans would sometimes fill half a page. Okay, so if you look at this, you can see that all the stuff at the bottom is marginal notes, and do they fill half the page? But when I was looking, you guys also know that Mike and I have a copy of a 1560. When I was looking at my 1560, it wasn't, I'm like, what are they talking about? Because if you see here, the notes are clearly not filling half the page. So I was confused until I realized, wait a minute, there is more than one what? Edition of the Geneva Bible, and that in these editions, they're not all the same. All right. So there's a revision of it in 1576 by Thompson, which we're talking about right now. So you have the original New Testament, you have the complete Bible, the original complete Bible in 1560, then you have this Thompson one here from 1576. And I wanted to bring the next book in, but I forgot to do it. A.S. Herbert, Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961, contains an entry for Thompson's 1576 revision of the Geneva Bible, which reads in part, quote, "The first edition of Thompson's revision of the Geneva New Testament. The alterations are mainly due to a comparison with Beza's Latin version of 1565. Thompson's emphatic rendering of the Greek article, example, John 1:1, in the beginning was that word, and that word was with God, and that word was God, exaggerates a tendency which Beza also displays. The notes are generally based on Beza's. This became the final and popular form of the Geneva New Testament." So I have the 1599 here. This is the other copy that I have. This is, as I said at the beginning, this is known as the Pilgrim Bible, because this is the one the pilgrims had with them in the Mayflower. If I go to John chapter 1, verse 1 in this Bible and I read it, it reads exactly like it says there in the notes. So there's an emphatic statement on this. So here's John 1:1. "In the beginning was that word, and that word was with God, and that word was God. The same was in the beginning with God." The reason, so that's a revision that Thompson is making to the 1560, emphasizing the definite article there in the way Beza did in his work. So there's a slight textual variation then between the 1560 Geneva Bible and what Thompson is doing here. So he is making some slight changes to the text as he is expanding these notes. So what I should have done, which I didn't do, is called this up to John so that we could see it, but I already did it at home, and it reads more like the King James reads. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." The word "that" is not, the word "that" is not in this text. Okay? Professor Daniel informs his readers that while Thompson made slight changes to the text, he completely rewrote and replaced the marginal notes of the original 1560 Geneva Bible. Quote, "Thompson's revision of the Geneva New Testament, based on Beza's important Latin edition of 1565, which also incorporated Beza's latest edition of the Greek New Testament. The notes to the 1557 and 1560 Geneva versions were completely replaced, and there are many small changes to the text in light of Beza's Latin and Greek readings. Thompson's new edition was published in 1576 and then incorporated into the standard Geneva Bible from 1587. So that from that day on, all Geneva Bibles are either Geneva or for about half editions, Geneva Thompson. So now we're going to be talking about a Geneva. A Geneva is talking about which edition? 1560. And then a Geneva Thompson. And this would be the one from what?
1576.
So this is where people get confused, because they don't realize that there's major revisions of the Geneva Bible. So you cannot just talk about, oh, the Geneva Bible, as though it's this sort of monolithic, unchanging thing, because it was revised at least two other times. Okay? So from this point forward, there were two different Geneva Bibles, the original 1560 edition and the Geneva Thompson editions. Noting this difference is crucial to understanding the printed history of the Geneva Bible. There are many more marginal notes in the Geneva Thompson editions, along with slight alterations to the biblical text itself. For more information on Lawrence Thompson, as well as the his revision of the Geneva Bible, interested parties are encouraged to read Chapter 20, Lawrence Thompson and the Revision of the Geneva New Testament, 1576, in Dr. David Daniel's book, The Bible in English, Its History and Influence. So, before we go any further, any questions?
Was that New Revised one as popular as the first one?
Yeah. So then what happens is you've got like two different ones that are out there, and half of the ones that were available by 1600 were this one or this one. Okay. Somebody else have a statement? Yeah.
Was the word referring to the Bible? And what's the significance of that versus the?
Well, the passage is referring to Christ, the Word, right? John 1:1 is referring to Christ. The insertion of the word that is made because he's looking at Beza's 1565 Greek Latin Bible. And Beza stressed that by the way he rendered it into Latin, and so Thompson is following that when he revises the Geneva Bible.
How does the word actually refer to Jesus? Why would they use the word?
It's Logos. Logos is the chief speaker. It's in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The passage is referring to that, and you go to verse 14, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Obviously talking about the incarnate Word, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. So it's referring to the second member of the Godhead, the Lord Jesus Christ.
And then why is that instead of the, all that much different?
I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying that's a notable variant between this one and this one. And a variant that I'll add was dropped later on. Okay? But that's the way they render it.
I think there wouldn't be much of a difference other than the is a definite article, and so then it would be used to denote like the rapture, the last day, like the biggest one. So Easter being the dawn, the morning. So now you have the focus on the Word, not just any logos or any word, but the definite Word.
Yeah, I would not prefer. In fact, I don't really like the Thompson reading.
Ultimately, we know from verse 14.
We know in the context what it's talking about, but I do think it weakens the statement a little bit in verse 1. So, where are we at? We at the bottom of page 4. So, before commenting on the 1599 edition of the Geneva Bible, we should note the 1579 Scottish printing of the Genevan text. Regarding the Scottish printing, Mombert states the following quote, "The first Bible printed in Scotland in 1579 was an exact reprint of the Geneva edition of 1561, so that would just been a second printing, with all the notes and facsimiles and cutouts and maps, so it was identical." So, here, Sylvia, I couldn't find the thing for pounds. So I just put the dollar sign in as a reminder that I needed to find it. I couldn't. So we need to change that. Yeah. Herbert states the following regarding the Scottish edition in his historical catalog. This historical catalog, by the way, which I forgot to bring, is just, it's about that fat, and it's just a catalog listing of every Bible printed in English between 1526 and 1961. I don't even think it has everyone in there, because I have another one called an American that just chronicles the American printings, and it's just as fat and has just as many in it. So there, you need to understand, there are literally millions of printings of the English Bible between 1526 and today. Yeah.
So I know I haven't been with you as you've been studying all this, but what's the driving force between all these revisions or in additions every few years? Is it people trying to edify themselves with what they're discovering about it, or is there something that's encouraging all these updates or whatever?
It's a great question. The short answer is I don't know, other than this is a time of great, this is smack dab in the middle of the first, 100 years of the Reformation. And these guys are, the Reformation reformers are literally recovering all sorts of tidbits of information and biblical manuscripts and knowledge and so on and so forth. I mean, Beza himself has something like five to six editions of the Greek New Testament that he publishes in his own lifetime, because they're constantly making more, discoveries of things. And I think it has more to do with trying to keep the information current and up to date more so than it does for individual glory. But I can't say for sure that somebody may not have been motivated along those lines. But I think it has more to do with trying to remain current with Reformation learning than it does necessarily personal glory. And I could say that for sure for the guys. I mean, the guys that did the Geneva Bible in Geneva, Switzerland, I mean, they were in, Beza was a teacher in Geneva, Switzerland, while these guys are there working on the Geneva Bible. So they were influenced directly by Calvin, by Beza, by all of these guys. And I think it's more to do with trying to keep the thing current with Reformation learning than it is about personal glory. But I'm sure, that may not have been the case for everybody involved. Yeah.
I think it had a lot to do with the marginal notes, don't you? I mean, mm-hmm. As we learned last week, some of the marginal notes were very Calvinistic, which some people didn't like. So they were updating the marginal notes, because this is the first time that people actually have the Bible in their own house. And
I'll say this. I think the marginal notes got more Calvinistic over time, not less Calvinistic. Because if I read the marginal notes in this 1599, and I compare them with some of the marginal notes in this 1560, the Calvinistic emphasis is just smacking you in the face when you read these marginal notes in this one. So I do think it had more to do with that theological preference and so on and so forth. And also the anti-monarchical notes against the divine right of kings concept are much more prevalent in the 1599 than this 1560. So, yeah, good question. So Herbert states the following regarding the Scottish edition in his historical catalog. So anywhere it says dollar signs, we're going to read pounds, okay? By order of the General Assembly, every parish in Scotland subscribed to the purchase price, so that'd be £4.13, I'm assuming? Shekels, shillings, whatever. Before the work was undertaken. So, understand, they're subscribing to it. What does that mean? Are they paying in advance? They're paying in advance. This is not uncommon, guys. This is a lot of the way big books were sold, by subscription, because it's a way for the printer to offset the cost of the project. So if I'm a printer and I've got a typeset, 1,500 pages of biblical text, that's not cheap. If everybody is paying in advance through a subscription, I can now offset my printing costs by doing it this way. And that's what's going on here with this Scottish edition.
Were they just printing like one chapter?
And they would print it in sections. So maybe they would print Genesis through Deuteronomy. And then they would print the next, maybe, I don't know, Joshua through Job or something. Or, I don't know what they exactly were, but that's the way they would do it. And then if you subscribed, then when you were done, you got a whole one. So you get each piece, and then when it was done, the project was done, you would get a whole one. In fact, I'm doing this right now with a book by Lawrence Vance on the printed history of the King James Bible. I've bought each chapter as he's released it, and then when the book is done, I'm going to get my own copy of the whole book that I won't have to pay anything else for because I've subscribed to it. So this kind of thing happens. You think about like Denis Diderot's encyclopedia, Enlightenment Encyclopedia. That was all sold by subscription. So this is a common practice back then to do it this way. So the Act of Scottish Parliament, that should say Scottish Parliament, I think, not Scots, but I'm going to flag that and I'll check that. An Act of Scottish Parliament passed in 1579, now watch this, ordered every householder worth 300, I think that should say, I don't know what the word was there, I couldn't hardly read it, it was very old information, of yearly rent, and every yeoman or burgess worth, this should say, 500 pounds stock, to have a Bible and Psalms book in the vulgar language in his house under the penalty of 10 pounds. So here the Scottish authorities are saying, you need to have a Bible in your house, and if you don't, we're going to fine you. So they're fining people for not having what? A Bible. Times have changed, have they not?
Was it also used as like a record keeping? Because a lot of births in Bibles were accepted as substitute for birth certificates.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't know if that was part of it or not. I think it's more just they wanted people to have the Bible.
Well, I mean, they didn't have a lot of books. I mean, that was probably the only book.
A lot of these people, this is the only book they probably have. The Scottish edition of 1579 seems to have been undertaken to aid in satisfying the Act of Scottish Parliament, which dates from the same year. Herbert's historical catalog also contains an entry for the 1559 revision of Junius. This entry reads in part, quote, Genevan version with Thompson's New Testament, but with Junius's revelation. So that would be this one right here. This one. And we need to add to our thing here. So then we have a Geneva, Thompson, Junius. And that one's from what? 1599. So there's a third one, and that's this one right here. This 1599 would be this Geneva, Thompson, Junius one that we're talking about right now. So this was Thompson's New Testament with Junius's Revelation. This is in most respects a reprint of the previous Quattro Geneva Bibles in Roman type, but the title pages are new, and Junius's Revelation here displaces Thompson's version of that book. Junius's Revelation appears in most of the folios and in most of the subsequent Roman letter Quattro Bibles. The section containing the Apocryphal, though included in the list of books, was apparently omitted from all except a few copies. So if you went to the title page, it would say Apocrypha, like we saw before. But then if you went to the page, it wasn't there. It was totally removed by this point, by 1599. There are many editions bearing this date, 1599, which, while agreeing closely, are yet distinct. No doubt a certain number of copies were originally issued in a mixed state. The nominal date 1599 is probably untrue in almost every case. They're apparently published at different times in Amsterdam and Dort and adopted by Barker. The phenomenon of the various editions described under the year 1599 and very similar edition of 1633 constitute one of the most curious problems in the bibliography of the English Bible. So there's a lot of variation. Regarding the 1599 revision, Professor Daniel states the following. Between 1560 and 1611, there were 64 separate editions of the 1560 Geneva Bible or New Testament. Between 1576 and 1611, there were 56 editions of the Geneva Bible or New Testaments only, all with Thompson's revisions. Editions of the Geneva Thompson Bibles from 1599 stay faithful to Thompson, except they may have completely new or full or very full notes on Revelation, reprinting the book by Junius. Where in Thompson's revision, the annotation to the short epistle of James is fuller than that to the whole of Revelation, the Junius notes to Revelation break all records, squeezing the text into a corner and being twice as full of a page, for example, of Romans. So let me show you what that's talking about. So if I find a page in Revelation here, so here's Revelation 13. This is the lines of biblical text. All of this is the notes. Okay, so what this is basically is a reprint of this Junius's guy, his book on Revelation appended to the notes to the Geneva Bible. So that's what that's talking about there. Therefore, we must note three distinct editions to the Geneva Bible were in print at the dawn of the 17th century. The 1560 Geneva, which was the original one, the Geneva Thompson of 1576, and the Geneva Thompson Junius. For more information on this third edition, interested parties are encouraged to read chapter 22, Geneva Thompson Junius, 1599, in the Bible in English, Its History and Influence by Dr. David Daniel. We could go on and on and on and talk about all the, we're not going to do that. If you're bored now, you'd even be more bored if we did that. So, let's look at the last point here, which is the Geneva and King James Bibles. So in 1610, so that would be the year before the King James was published. The King James was published in 1611. So 1610 would be the year before that. In 1610, the Geneva Bible was 50 years old. The following year, in 1611, the Authorized Version would appear for the first time. Professor David Daniel sums up the situation with the Geneva Bible on the eve of the release of the King James. Quote, in 1610, when it was 50 years old, it was, as remarked above, in three versions, apparently unstoppable. It already had 120 different editions, not reprintings. It went through 140 editions all told in under a century. It was the Bible of poets, politicians, and preachers, even anti-Puritan preachers like Laud, as the following chapters will show. So, by 1610 is the Geneva Bible hands down the best-selling English Bible and the Bible that more Englishmen are reading as their Bible of choice. Okay? Alistair McGrath, author of In the Beginning, The Story of the King James Bible and How It Changed a Nation, a Language, and a Culture, offers perhaps the most succinct and informative treatment of the history of the Geneva Bible after the publication of the Authorized Version in 1611. According to Professor McGrath, the King James did not immediately supplant the Geneva Bible among Englishmen. So let me just stop there before I read the quote. Many, many, many King James advocates that I know act like, oh, well, yay, the Word of God in English, finally available in 1611. And they just, that the whole English-speaking world just immediately switched from using the Geneva Bible and picked up a King James. That did not happen. Okay? The irrefutable evidence is that far from rushing out to buy or make use of the new translation, which would have been the King James or the Authorized Version, people preferred to use the English translation from 50 years earlier, the Geneva Bible. The simple truth is that the new Bible, the King James, was initially regarded with polite disinterest. It wasn't like they just ignored it, basically. Nobody at the time really liked the new translation very much. Even some of those who were prominently involved in the translation of the King James Bible seemed hesitant to use it, preferring to cite the Geneva Bible instead, hardly a commendation of their work. The King James Bible might be the Bible of the religious and political establishment, but it had a long way to go before it became the Bible of the English people. Okay? Inconvenient truth for some people, but a truth nonetheless. Even after 1616, the printings of the Geneva Bible on English shores ceased due to political pressures, So after 1616, they're not allowed to print the Geneva Bible anymore. Okay? On English shores. The Geneva Bible remained the number one selling Bible in England as copies were easily imported from the European mainland. English policies related to the English Civil War that we will not delve into at this time greatly impacted the fortunes of the English Bible. Suffice it to say now, we will study this history in more detail in a future lesson, between 1630 and the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, the Bible of choice was impacted by who was ruling the nation. Okay? So, I know you all know everything there is to know about the English Civil War and the Puritans under Cromwell fighting against the Royalists, right? Well, what Bible do you think the Royalists preferred? The King James Bible. Why? Because it was issued by who? It was authorized by the king, right? Which Bible do you think the Puritans preferred? The Geneva Bible. So when Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans are running England under the Commonwealth, which Bible do you think they promoted? The Geneva Bible. When the monarchy is eventually restored and Charles II is made reinstituted back to the throne, reestablishing the monarchy, which Bible do you think he is going to promote and which Bible do you think he is going to suppress? He's going to promote the King James, and from that point forward, which Bible will start to fall increasingly out of favor? The Geneva Bible. But the politics of the situation influenced the fortunes of these different English Bibles in the first 50 years of the existence of the authorized version. When Cromwell and the Puritans were in charge, the Geneva was the Bible of choice. When Charles II restored the monarchy in 1660 after a period of civil war, the authorized version finally supplanted the Geneva Bible as the Bible of choice among Englishmen. That said, the enduring impact of the Geneva Bible can be seen in the following statement from the pen of Alistair McGrath, quote, "The popularity of the Geneva Bible rested not so much on the translation itself as on the explanatory material appended to the translation." So, what was it that the people were in love with? The actual reading of the text? Or the notes? It was the notes. It was arguably the first study Bible. Okay? So why some reason should not the Geneva translation be replaced with the King James Bible while retaining the Geneva notes? Between 1642 and 1715, at least 9 editions, 8 of which originated from Amsterdam, are known of the King James Bible with the Geneva notes. So those would be Bibles that had the King James text, biblical text, with what marginal notes? The Geneva marginal notes. Okay? Now, when we get to the 1600s, I'm going to say a lot more about this time period and the fortunes of these two Bibles and how they're sort of duking it out during that time frame. But right now, I just want you to see in a general sense what was going on there. And then you'll see our last point here. In our next lesson, we will begin a consideration of the Bishop's Bible from 1568. So, we got a couple minutes here before we have to pack up. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
With the King James Version, was there still Tyndale, who obviously the greatest influence on their writings as far as their translation, but was there one of the Geneva, one of the several Geneva translations that they leaned on more than others?
So, with the King James Bible, there is like 7 to 10 rules that are given to the translators that they're supposed to follow when they do their work. The first one was that, and this is why the Bishop's Bible and the next one we're going to talk about is so important. The first one was that they were to follow the Bishop's Bible as their base text unless the truth of the original determined otherwise. Okay? Then rule like 7 or 9, I'm drawing a blank on which one, listed out other ones they were to consult. So if they determined that the king, that the bishop's reading was not the one that they wanted, then it literally listed in the rules which other ones they were supposed to look at. And it included Coverdale, the Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, etc. The Geneva Bible is listed as one of the ones they're to consult in this process. Now, am I answering your question?
Yeah, I think so. It's a little different than what we think of it sometimes. But now, Cromwell, I thought he was a contemporary of Tycho.
Well, that was a different Cromwell.
No, it was just an heir of the
other. I don't even know if it's in the same Cromwell family, if you will, but it's a totally different guy. That Cromwell you're referring to is from the 1520s, 1530s. The one I refer to is from the 16, like over 100 years later. Yeah.
Did they refer back to Latin? They used to teach Latin in schools. I'm assuming it was for that reason.
They used the translation. You mean the King James translators?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they looked at Latin. They say they look at Latin in the preface.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're literally looking at everything that was available to look at.
Right.
Greek, Hebrew, Latin, German, all the English translations, commentaries, they looked even at like Syriac, they looked at all this stuff when they did it, as much stuff as they had available to them to look at. But the bishop's Bible is the base text. So, I've told you guys this before, but there's a document at Bodleian Library in England called Bod 1602. What Bod 1602, when the King James translation was authorized, King James ordered the printer to print, the King's printer to print 40 unbound copies of a bishop's Bible. So that they could write in them and stuff like that. In Bodleian Library, there's a document called Bod 1602, which is a 1602 edition of the bishop's Bible with the handwritten notes of the translators in the margin. So, a lot of stuff has been said about the King James that's not wholly accurate. But they absolutely followed rule number one. Because we have the evidence of it. The historical surviving evidence of them literally say, I'm just going to give you an example. Let's say we have the word name here in English where they've crossed this out and they've written something else in the margin. And then if you compare this Bod 1602 document with a King James, you can see that they made that exact revision, that exact change that is noted in Bod 1602 showed up in the 1611 King James Bible. The amount of evidence that we have for this stuff is so overwhelming. It is maddening to me personally that so many King James advocates are completely ignoring all this stuff. And they don't even want to talk about it. Because it rattles the cage of their accepted viewpoint. For me, whatever I'm going to believe, I want it to correspond with what the facts actually are. Okay? But now we do have to quit. If anybody has any questions, you can raise them while I pack up.